Accession number 10409, Reel 2.
Mr. Gordon Himes, Reel 2. While you were at Charterhouse, did you have any ideas about the approach of war? Were you expecting it, you and the other boys at the school in 1914?
Well, of course, when I when I went there in 1912, there was nothing indicating that there was a war. And or, in fact, in 1913, we had an officers' training corps, which was when I first went there until the war, was voluntary. They didn't make everybody join.
Did you join it?
Yes, I joined it.
And what did it do?
We used to have drills. I'm not quite certain. It wasn't every day. The week after the last, before lunch, we had the commander of the OTC was a Colonel Smart, who was one of the staff of the teachers. He was a very extraordinary man. He couldn't pronounce his R's, and he was always known as Fwanky Start, but he was a very hard-working bloke. But the absolute anchor, sheet anchor of the Corps, was the Sergeant Major, who was an ex-Grenadier Guardsman, Sergeant Major Locke, and he was a magnificent man for the job, and really taught us a great deal. We were armed with rather old Lee Enfield rifles, and we all learnt our rifle drill. And then, once a year, after the summer quarter, we used to go to camp. And that was sometimes on Salisbury Plain at Tidworth Pennings. But the last camp I attended, which was in the summer of 1914, was at Rugeley in Staffordshire. And it was during that camp that war was declared. And the whole thing was closed down immediately, and all the regular army staff were called off immediately. And we were left to strike tents and generally clear up and then go home.
How did you feel about the war?
Well, I really don't know. I think everybody thought it was a very good thing, and we got to stop the Kaiser. And it had a big effect on the school. Some of the masters were called up fairly soon, and a lot of the boys who had just left went into the Army or the Navy or the Royal Flying Corps or the Royal Naval Air Service more or less immediately. The masters who were of military age and were left were what was then called attested. And they used to wear a red armband with GR on it, Gorgeous Ricks. Everybody used to call them Gorgeous Ricks. And most of them joined the OTC in the ranks. At that time, I was, I've forgotten if I was a corporal or a sergeant, but very soon afterwards I had command of my house section, and I had two masters in it. And you had to be very careful of them, but they were very good. Then, of course, apart from the fact that there were a lot of very early casualties among boys who had just left and went out to France practically immediately. And incidentally, my elder half-brother, Alec, who had been at Aldenham and then went to an agricultural college up in Cumberland called Aspatria, and he joined the Royal Fusiliers right at the start, and unfortunately he was killed fairly early in 1915. The biggest excitement, I think, was when our first VC was gained by a boy who had been the head of the school. His name was Mac Nair, and there was a special half holiday proclaimed for him. But unfortunately, he was killed shortly afterwards. But there were a lot of my contemporaries, a bit older than me, who were killed.
Did you have any trouble with people trying to join up underage in the upper years?
No, I don't think so. I can't remember any. Most of them stayed on until they were 18. I think 18 was the age where you had to.
The OTC, what you were a sergeant in it, what were your responsibilities as a sergeant in the OTC?
You were in charge of your house section, and you drilled them and altogether taught them what was necessary and recommended any of them for promotion to Lance Corporal or Corporal. But it wasn't a very onerous job.
Did you have any rifle practice? Shooting?
Oh, there was a shooting range there always before the war. And everybody had to go down and shoot there and show their proficiency or otherwise.
So it was now compulsory to be in the OTC, was it?
As soon as war started, it became compulsory.
And did you do any other training other than the shooting and the training and the drill?
I don't think we did. I can't remember anything. We used to have a few field days, generally once a term, where we went out there and did an not very far away, Milford Common or something like that, and performed an exercise against an invisible enemy. And, of course, there were umpires there assessing what you could do or if you were dead or not.
Had you practiced the tactical exercises? Had you practiced them before you went on this manoeuvre?
No.
So it was...
No, you hadn't really. But, of course, apart from the individual section drill, we did company drill and battalion drill, and we learnt a lot about that. And later on, it became very useful, to me anyhow, knowing how to drill a battalion. I'm going to relate one rather comic incident which happened during early morning chapel one day. The organ in the chapel was a very old one and used to, at times, break down entirely. And one morning, in early morning, it so happened that the second verse of the hymn that morning started dark and cheerless is the morn, unaccompanied by thee. And of course, the organ had broken down and there's not a sound for it. And I don't think there was a straight face in chapel.
Did you enjoy your time at Charterhouse then?
Yes, on the whole, I did very much. And I've all, and since then, I've been a very loyal and keen old Carthusian, and I still keep in touch with the school. I go to the old Carthusian day down at the school in July, and I go to the annual Founders Day service and dinner in Old Charterhouse in Smithfield, and most of the houses have old boys associations, and I belong to the old Robinites, and we have only just recently had our annual dinner.
Did you feel, it was a boarding school, did you feel lonely at all away from your parents? Or?
No, I didn't really. I was never homesick.
As the war went on and you approached, you left in 1916, but as you went into 1916 and the war became more and more serious in a sense, were you aware of that?
Oh, I think we were, and it was quite early on, but I'd definitely decided that I was going into the flying services. And during the war, I had read every possible thing I could about the flying services and the machines and this, that and the other. And I was very keen on seaplanes, so I decided that I'd go for the Royal Naval Air Service.
What made you keen on seaplanes?
I don't know why, but I just was.
So you decided that that was where you were going to go. How did you go about getting the RNAS?
You put in an application form, which was forwarded, I think, by the commanding officer of the OTC, and that went up to the Admiralty, and in due course, you were called up for an interview at the Admiralty. And that was some time, I think, early in October 1916. It was rather a frightening affair, because you were sitting at one side of a table containing about four or five brass hats who fired questions at you. Some of them were just catches, others were quite sensible questions. At any rate, I then had to go...
What sort of questions, can you remember?
Oh, what you were keen on, your sports and your occupations during your leisure time, and why you wanted to join the service, and... all that sort of thing. It's rather difficult to remember now. But at any rate, I then went into another room where I was medically examined and passed, and then I went back to school.
Was it a severe medical? Was it a proper medical?
Oh, it was a proper, moderately proper, and of course eyesight too was one of the important things. And then I had to await my call up, and I was called up on December the 17th and told to report at the Crystal Palace, which was the headquarters of most of the naval reserve units. There was the RNVR, the RNR, and all that sort of thing, and it was a huge place, Crystal Palace. I was billeted out at a big house called Ashurst, which was quite near. And
hang on, you'd been commissioned as a probationary flight officer, is that right? offline?
No, you weren't commissioned then until you'd passed out.
So you're
on. I think you were commissioned, yes. I'm not quite certain. I could easily tell by looking up my commission.
Where did you get your uniform from? Was that provided?
No. You had to provide your own uniform. And that was, most people used to go to a well-known firm called Gieves in Savile Row. And it was an ordinary, more or less, naval uniform with buttons, but you had no rank rings on your sleeve, but you just had a little gilt bird.
And what did that indicate?
Oh, that was just part of the uniform, the same way as you had the same gilt bird on your naval headband instead of the anchor.
Now, while you were at the Crystal Palace,
yes.
What were you doing there? You were billeted out at Ashurst. What training did you get while you were there?
Well, the first thing was that you were handed over to colour sergeants of the Royal Marines. There were five or six of them, and you were divided up into sections, and each section was given to a certain colour sergeant, and they drilled you, and my gosh, they drilled you hard, and I was very thankful that I knew my drill pretty well from the OTC. You used to have to fall in early morning on the big terraced ground, and all the troops in the place took place in what's known in the Navy as divisions, and you were told off to take a certain section, and you had to double down and stand in front of them, and I don't think you had to do any more much. But the silly thing was, it was a very cold, freezing winter, and our dress was a white flannel shirt open at the neck, your jacket, and white flannel trousers of all things with gaiters at the bottom. And it was very slippery. You had to run down one bank, and you frequently fell and made an awful mess of your trousers. But that didn't matter in the slightest, as long as you turned up next day in a clean pair. Anyway, after that...
What did you think of the instructors, these colours?
Oh, they were very good. Very hot.
What about your fellow trainees? What were they like?
A mixed lot, quite a number of very raw Canadians who hadn't a clue of anything. I remember one of them being hauled out in front of his section and told to give the order to take two steps forward. And his answer was, "Two steps forward, come." Roars of laughter from everybody. They were a nice lot, but they were very, very raw. And there was others who were more or less like myself. A few colonials.
Were they all from similar backgrounds to yourself, besides being Canadian?
Yes, I think they were. At any rate, one thing, we used to mess in the Crystal Palace, and as far as I remember, the mess bill was 1 shilling a day, and and the catering was done by J. Lyons and Co. Another thing I remember was the commandant of the Crystal Palace. I'm not quite certain if he was an air if he was a naval commodore, but it was Sir Richard Williams Bulkeley. And his second-in-command was, I think he was a commander, Sir Harry Mannering.
Would you see much of these officers?
No, not very much.
How did you take to the naval lifestyle and discipline?
I took it perfectly well. It was very interesting, and you soon got into the way of it.
Did you think having been at a boarding school, a public school, had helped?
I think so, yes. But it was quite a pleasant life. That was on the 17th of December I went there, and I remember we were allowed 2 or 3 days at Christmas to go home. And I did go home. My parents then lived in Sussex.
They moved from Watford to
Sussex, just a year before the war, to a place, little place called Eastergate, which was about 4 miles north of Bognor. In those days, it wasn't Bognor Regis. Then we also had a lot of lectures, either on aircraft and air engines. Some of them were practical. We had to strip an engine and examine all its past. And there were various lectures on various things connected with the service. And after that, we were sent to Cranwell, which was the central flying school at the time for the Navy. And that was...
I thought you went to Chingford first.
No, Cranwell first. Oh, wait a minute. I'm sorry.
Chingford was in
19th. Yes, that's right. We went to Chingford first, which was a very rough aerodrome, with a lot of streams running across it, and they had board bridges across where you had to taxi. And it was just by Ponder's End Station. And the other side of the road was the, I think it was the King George the Fifth or Sixth Reservoirs, which had a great attraction for people who had engine trouble, and there were quite a lot of them who landed in the water. At any rate,
Did you have your lectures? Did you have them at Chingford, or did you have them at Crystal Palace? I would have thought they were at Chingford, weren't they?
At Chingford you had much more advanced lessons for the first fortnight or so, and you had taught the rudiments of flying and a bit of navigation and all that sort of thing.
Did you take to all this with your
background? Oh, yes. Yeah. Oh, I lapped it up. And then you were allotted to a flying instructor, of which there were about four. I was very lucky and was allotted to the group commanded by a man who afterwards became very famous as a playwright, Ben Travers. He was a flight commander. And the machines we had, I was also very pleased about, because that was the Morris Farman Longhorn aircraft, which had big curved skids running right up and supporting the front elevator. And it had a 70 horsepower air-cooled Renault engine. And they were very easy to fly, very comfortable, not very fast. I suppose cruising speed was something like 50 to 60 knots, and I was taken up for my first flight by another very well-known pilot who was one of the leading civilians, that was Warren Merriam, and he took me up on a Morris Farman and flew me around just to have my first experience of flying.
That was on, of course, I've got your logbook here, on the 6th of February 1917. What did you think of this first experience?
I liked it immensely. And the funny thing was, and still is, but I cannot stand heights on buildings. Or going up ladders, it really gets me down. I hate it. But flying made absolutely no impression on me at all in that respect. And I think it's due to the fact that flying, you're not connected with anything on the ground. Whereas if you walk up a ladder or look over a high building, you've got the sensation of being connected with the ground, but I don't know what it is, but it's lasted the rest of my life.
So that was your first flight, and then after that I see that you were with Travers,
with
dual control.
Yes.
What were these dual control machines like? How did they work?
Well, they had two sets of controls. In the Morris Farman, I've forgotten if they were side by side or in tandem. I think they were probably in tandem. And the controls were very simple. You had a central joystick with a Morris Farman, you had sort of ram's horns, which you could rock and push backwards and forwards. When you push the controls forward or backwards, it worked the elevators. There was a front elevator carried on these big skids and a rear elevator on the tail. And if you rocked the handles on these sort of ram's horns, but I don't think ram's horn is a very good description because ram's horns go straight up. But at any rate, they worked the ailerons, which were controls on the trailing edge of the wings, and banked the machine either way, because one lot went down and the other one was up. And of course there was the engine switch, and on the dash there were a couple of spillet levels, one of them across horizontal, which showed that the machine was tilted in either direction, and another one vertical, which showed if you were flying level or shooting up in the air. But otherwise there was really nothing.
How long was it before Travers allowed you to take control for a short period?
Well, I think, as far as I can remember, I'd done 3 hours, 20 minutes dual before he sent me off on my first solo flight.
Oh, no, I meant before you were allowed, when you were dual flying. Did he let you straight away?
Oh, yes, straight away you kept your hands on the controls very lightly. And incidentally, I forgot the foot pedals, which worked the rudder. You kept your hands and feet very lightly on the controls, and then you felt what he was doing. And in certain conditions, if he was going down or coming up,